As I began to prepare this sermon on change and cycles, I was sitting outside on the patio of a convalescent facility where my cousin, my beloved cousin Sam, is dying. I've lit candles for him from time to time, so those of you who have been here for a while know that. The reason I'm in a sling is that Sam needed some help, and I needed to try to lift him, and I was feeling young and invulnerable and full of pep and energy, and so I tried to lift him so that we could change a pad, and I heard, and normally I don't speak a lot of OSA, but I heard a large OSA pop in my shoulder and retired so that the family wouldn't feel bad that I'd gotten myself injured in my own false sense of invulnerability, and started to work out on the patio so that they would not see me twitching. The Sam story is really part of this sermon because here is this extraordinary person, brilliant, an editor and publisher of L.A. Lawyer, before that Time Life series books back when he lived in Boston, Princeton graduate, the historian of our family, a young man at 63, and a fast and sad story where I got a call from him saying that he fell and was going to go to the ER and could he come to our house and recoup because he lived up a couple of flights. And I said, of course, and then got a call from the ER that he needed surgery. And then after the surgery, the question was why the bone broke with the fall, and it was kidney cancer, gone to the bone, gone to the liver, gone to the heart, and a very bad prognosis. And in a very short period of time, he has gone from truly living to truly dying. And when I was there that day, he was in a never-never land, in not truly living and not yet dead, not completely aware of what was going on around him, but knowing that he was surrounded by love and by caring, knowing the names of the people, but his world had shrunk down as his body had. And I sat outside, and the pain was much more in my heart than it was in my shoulder, and that was appropriate. One insight is that you're supposed to not worry about the little things because there are people going through the big things, and I've been telling myself that. And what I found is that someone else's suffering does not alleviate your own. It only makes you have two problems, your pain and feeling guilty that you are recognizing your pain. His situation I'll return to at the end. But it is about the issue of transience and of change and of how vulnerable we sometimes feel and how immortal we feel at other times, and how our sense of permanence is impermanent, and how the feelings that we have, almost like, looking for the teenagers, almost like when we were, I'll make it this way, when we were all younger, are just so immediate and so important. Our joys will last forever. Our sorrows and our despair, they too will last forever, and it's really hard to believe that life cycles, our own personal lives, the lives of our communities, the lives of institutions and of nations. It is so difficult when it is cold and you're shivering to believe that you will ever complain if it ever becomes warm again. But it will become warm again, and you will complain as I will complain, and then swear that I'll never complain about the cold. And, of course, that will be a lie because I will complain about the cold. When we are in the middle of a war, it is impossible to imagine peace. when we are blessed, if only for moments, with peace, whether peace from war or peace in our own hearts, it is almost impossible to think of those things being reversed. My very first traveling sermon, that is a sermon that I wrote that I could take on the road with some confidence that it would be well received, was about order and chaos, and about how we human beings, if our lives are too orderly, we mess them up. If our communities are doing too well, we'll throw something into the middle, because chaos, because order is too much and too boring, and we need a little bit of excitement. But when the chaos gets to be too great, we will rapidly trade that freedom and that chaos again for a sense and a semblance of order. We build houses of cards and then knock them over, as I watched my children and as I now watch my grandchildren build and destroy, build and destroy. You know, it's, I think, really only Hinduism that really gets the relationship within the religious framework of creation and destruction, and how they are each necessary for the other and are related. And we have this in our own worlds. We have it in our own cycles of history. Right now in America and in much of the West, there is a sense of fear, even terror, because our world changed forever on 9/11. I'm going to revisit that forever part. On 9/11, when we became terrified. The object of terror is terror, is to make people afraid. And when we are afraid, it's hard to imagine not being afraid. And when we're not afraid, it's hard to imagine being afraid. Right now, most Americans, I think, believe that we are in an endless twilight war against all Islam and all Arabs, and let's add the Persians too, just for fun. We are not. Wars end. My mother-in-law, who could not foretell the future when she was in Auschwitz, could not have imagined surviving the day, no less the war, no less coming to America, to Iowa, and having a life and having a family. She certainly could not have imagined 50 years later going back to Poland and seeing old friends and some who may have betrayed her and her other Jewish neighbors, but she did. I am confident that in the middle of torture, John McCain could not imagine coming back to the United States, and certainly couldn't begin to imagine voluntarily going back to Vietnam and embracing Vietnamese. This is the nature of our humanity. We are an immediate species. We feel deeply what we feel and cannot imagine the opposite. We are swing from polarity to polarity. When you look at our American history, and to some extent English history and European, but I'm focusing on us, at the end of the 19th century, there was unbridled optimism. The 20th century was going to be amazing. From Marx, Freud, and Darwin, the old roots of superstition and determinism had been uprooted, and we were free. We had in the Industrial Revolution was in full force. We were building. The proof of our progress was all the smoke we were pouring into the sky. That was great. And the 20th century, with science, with reason, with medicine, with the old religious superstitions being swept away, was going to be a time of peace and plenty. It was inevitable, because science would cure our diseases, and we would have enough food and enough money, and everything was going to be great. The century didn't work out as the optimists thought you might have noticed. There was World War I, the war to end all wars, and a barbarism and a hatred as people, Europeans, turned on each other to settle or pretend to settle or think they were settling old disputes about territory, about nationalism, with a barbarism that was extraordinary. This century has, this past century has taken us from Kitty Hawk to intercontinental ballistic missiles. Our science has done wonders in healing, and it has also done wonders in destroying. When we were in the depths of World War I, it was hard to imagine peace. Yet when peace came, there were the roaring 20s that roared in, and they partied like there was no tomorrow until the stock market crash of 1929. And then the party ended. They couldn't imagine the party ending, but it ended. And we were in a depression. And in the midst of that depression, there were many people who thought, we are doomed. We will fly apart as a nation. That we have people on the right who are fascists. We had my relatives on the left who were card-carrying communists, not violent communists, only intellectual communists. But we could have pulled ourselves apart and never come out of that depression. But Roosevelt, somebody who was loved by many and hated by many as being a socialist who hated America, you know, seeing how patterns of history repeat themselves, printed money. And we started to come out of the depression. And then certain conservatives said, you know, the deficit's really terrible, so let's pull back from all this spending, and the recovery stalled. And then there was World War II, again, that we couldn't really imagine, and most wanted to stay out of. And it made the barbarism of World War I look like a picnic, as millions upon millions upon millions died. 6 million Jews in the Shoah, 20 million Russians in the war, and untold numbers throughout all of Europe, and then add Asia. And it was extraordinary. And how could anybody imagine that after we had, and I mentioned that 2 weeks ago, after we had hated the beast of Joseph Stalin, when Hitler turned on him, he became Uncle Joe. And then as soon as the war ended, he became Stalin the Beast again. We cycle faster and faster as time goes on, and it's hard to keep up with it. After World War II, we had the relative peace and prosperity of the Eisenhower years. It was a very good time to be a white male. It was also a very good time not to have any left-wing ideas because Joe McCarthy would come after you. It was paradise for some, but then this was interrupted by the fact that people of color who had fought in our wars and who were good enough to fight and to die thought maybe a voice and a vote was good for something. And the civil rights movement was not born then, but it was born to the consciousness of white people then. And it became an important agenda item and a defining movement in the late 50s and in the early 60s. And I have to say that I twitch when people refer to this as the post-civil rights era, as if, well, we've done that. We're finished. We've achieved nirvana. We don't achieve nirvana, not on this plane. So we got into the 60s, and the 60s were a time of chaos. You might remember. There was the Vietnam War and the protests. There was the constructive engagement of the civil rights movement. There was, they tell me, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but I don't remember a thing. My generation, incidentally, was supposed to be completely passive because we were the first generation raised on television, and we were going to sit on the sidelines and just be entertained. Didn't work that way. We took to the streets. And after a while, we decided to turn a little bit inward and with experiments. I love the term experimenting with drugs. Makes it feel like you're in a lab coat and you're running a control group. We experimented with drugs and then went from self-medication to self-meditation as we started to explore inwardly. And we partied like the 60s would never end, and they did. And then we get unforeseen things. The Soviet Union went out of business. The Berlin Wall came down. Later on, Clinton, a Democrat, balanced the budget on the backs of the poor, but that's another story, but balanced the budget. There were conservative writers, intellectuals, who were talking about, well, we have reached the end of history. We have figured out the end of the business cycle. We will have growth and prosperity and democracy now and forevermore, worlds without end, hallelujah. Democracy is sweeping Eastern Europe. Democracy is sweeping Southeast Asia and Latin America, and everything is tickety-boo. That's Sylvia Fine and Danny Kaye's term. Everything is tickety-boo. And then out of the sky on 9/11, we had a rude awakening where simmering discontent in the Muslim world and the Arab world, two distinct communities, boiled over and brought down our confidence, brought down some towers, brought down some safeguards on our own freedom and liberty, until we as a people were, in the words of the gospel, sore afraid. And here we are, engaged in this eternal twilight struggle, just like that eternal twilight struggle with the Soviet Union. And our party ended in the late 20th century, just as that party ended in the 1920s. And from the depths, it's hard to see the light. But the truth of history is wars end. Eternal enmities are as transient as eternal truths, as eternal peace, as eternal bubbles that only expand and expand and expand. The nature of bubbles is to burst. And the nature of what follows that bursting is a sense of anxiety, of fear, even of depression. But like wars, these two end. And business cycles, community cycles, hearts cycle as we come out of these situations which at the time seem to be permanent and eternal. Four days after I visited Sam, they had changed the medications, and he returned into being himself, fully conscious, fully aware, fully able to understand what was going on, to communicate his wants, his needs, his love, his appreciation of all the people who have shown up to give him their love. And he had this time of clarity. And so his diminishment that I reported at the beginning was changed. But yet, the prognosis doesn't change. Just as on the bright, sunny day, we know that night will come. Night will come for him sooner rather than later. Night comes for each and for all. And our job as human beings is to know the cycles of darkness and light, to know that when the sun is out and we can't see the moon is still there, to know in the darkness of night when we can't see the sun still burns, the sun sets, the sun also rises on our world, in our lives, and in our hearts. We are on a cycle a cycle of nature, a cycle of life, a cycle of mood. And sometimes we don't think that we can pedal fast enough. But this is a beautiful and remarkable existence and life and consciousness that we all share today. One of the most famous sermons in Unitarian history is about the transient and the impermanent in life. The transient and the permanent in life. Everything is transient. Transience is the permanent condition. And we share that condition. And when we share it mindfully, not always joyfully, there are times of despair, of a midnight of the soul. That is part of our experience. But in those depths and out of those depths, we are a people who believe in a sunrise. Sunrise, sunset. Swiftly flow our days. We share these days together with great gladness. Gladness that life is here. Gladness for the challenges of a world that needs us, our wisdom, our thoughts, our dedication, and our passion. We share the idea that the world is not finished, and while it takes more than one person working together, we commit ourselves to heal this beautiful, broken, imperfect world with our own beautiful, broken, imperfect selves, and joining together to do something of service and something wonderful.